The time is 9 minutes after 8 o'clock, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine. Last week, the United States House of Representatives voted on a bill to loosen the rules on funding embryonic stem cell research. However, if they want to override the veto promised by President Bush, they are 35 votes short. The debate only intensifies with last week's news that skin cells from mice were created to act like stem cells. Some say that this shows research can progress without harming embryos, while others say that it might not work with human skin cells. This hour, we look into the politics and developing science of stem cell research. Where do you stand? Do you think that President Bush should step aside and allow more federal funds to be spent on research? Is it morally wrong to use embryos, which some say are human life? What do you think is the promise of new alternatives? If you have a question or comment, you can call our toll-free line, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or if you're in Madison, use our local number, 263-1890, 263-1890. Our guest this morning is joining us by telephone, and we'll be talking about the politics of all of this stem cell research and so forth, and the status of that research today. Our guest is Alta Shero, Warren P. Knowles Professor of Law and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also co-chair of the Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research Advisory Committee at the National Academy of Sciences. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it just seems to me, and reading some articles in preparation for this interview, it seems to me that every time there's some political action either contemplated or taken regarding embryonic stem cell research, a new piece of scientific research emerges suggesting that it's not necessary to use human embryos to advance this type of research. Is there a conspiracy here, or is it just coincidence?
You know, this question actually has arisen before, and indeed the Washington Post had a piece by Rick Weiss talking about this suspicion that the medical journals are somehow trying to undermine those people who promote more funding for this research. I suspect that there is no conspiracy. It's simply that this is an extraordinarily active area of research, and it seems like almost every few weeks we see another article, whether it's on mouse or human, adult stem cell or embryonic stem cell, that documents some incremental advance in this field. So no matter when you have your political debate, there's likely to be some news item that can be used by either proponents or opponents of more funding.
Is the debate over embryonic stem cell research really a debate about abortion?
In many ways, it is a proxy for the debate about abortion, yes, because the bill that was being debated in the Congress did not suggest funding for the destruction of embryos. That is actually prohibited by something called the Dickey-Wicker Amendment, which was enacted in the mid-1990s and has been reenacted since then. The debate has been about whether the government should fund research on the laboratory-based cell lines that exist after somebody else using private money has worked with embryos to create those cell lines. And so because this debate was not about funding embryo research directly, it is really standing more as a symbol of a debate, or symbolically representing a debate over our comfort with the use of early forms of human life prior to sentience, whether it's for preserving our futures in the case of abortion, or for medical research in the case of embryonic stem cell research.
Of course, in Wisconsin, embryonic stem cell research became an issue in the last race for governor. Governor Doyle making a campaign issue out of Wisconsin's preeminence in stem cell research. This seems to be almost more of a political than a scientific issue. What is the, if there is a way of expressing what the thinking is in the scientific community, how is this looked at in terms of all the politics that goes into it?
Well, first, there's no one voice within the scientific community, and opinions will range. However, I think it's fair to say that the consensus within that community, represented by petitions to the government, by reports by the National Academy of Sciences, and by professional scientific groups, would suggest that scientists believe that all avenues of research need to be pursued simultaneously, and that it is not productive to isolate a few areas of research and say we'll fund only these because they are politically safe and leave others unfunded. The reason scientists want to see all avenues pursued is because science does not proceed in a predictable linear fashion. Discoveries occur across all areas of research and at many different points in time, so that the work currently going on with adult stem cells, for example, which have been shown to have a little more flexibility or plasticity than had been expected, that work was furthered by the work on embryonic stem cells. And prior to the excitement about the embryonic stem cell work done here at Wisconsin, nobody thought that adult stem cells had this capacity in any setting. So these areas work together. They work in a kind of synergistic fashion. And patients who are hoping for some kind of therapy before their diseases take their lives or their health also want to see as many avenues pursued as possible.
Let's maybe just take a moment here and make sure that we have all of our terms correct. This is a stem cell research. Embryonic stem cell research is a term that's thrown about a lot in newspapers and on television and radio and on the Internet. What are we really talking about here?
Well, there are many different kinds of stem cells in our bodies, and they have varying degrees of what scientists would call plasticity, what we might understand as the capacity to become various kinds of body tissues. Embryonic stem cells exist within embryos that are simply a few days old, and if they are extracted and then maintained in a laboratory in a very specific set, under a very specific set of conditions, they can be coaxed to replicate themselves without starting down that path of tissue specialization. So now you have an ongoing collection of cells that you can work with, for example, to try and direct them to make only the tissue that you need for your experiment or your therapy. Now, in ordinary human development, as the embryo develops into a fetus and the fetus into a baby and the baby into an adult, we also have other kinds of stem cells. Those stem cells we call adult stem cells, even if they occur in babies. And they are simply an intermediate step between the embryonic stem cell, which can make all kinds of tissues, and the final cells of our bodies that are completely committed, like our skin cells and our brain cells. These intermediate adult stem cells exist in a kind of partially specialized state. For example, you can have what they call hematopoietic or blood adult stem cells, which are now partially specialized to form blood products, but they haven't gone down the path to make all the specific kinds of blood cells. These adult stem cells have traditionally been understood to be inflexible. That is, once partially specialized toward becoming blood products, they could make only blood products. But the work with embryonic stem cells has made people look more closely at adult stem cells and ask, can we perhaps switch them from a path toward blood stem cells and instead move down a path toward, for example, brain cells? And that research has had some very intriguing initial results that suggest that we might possibly be able to do that. But it is still a very tentative area of research.
Well, have we actually seen the fruit of this research? In other words, there's been a lot of talk about stem cell research as being a path toward solving some diseases like Parkinson's disease, diabetes, and other a host of other maladies that afflict people all over the world. Have we actually seen anything come out of this that that we can say, yes, you know what, we did this research and we came up with this cure for this or that disease?
No, it's too new. We've seen intermediate successes of various types with various kinds of stem cells. So, for example, we have for decades used adult blood stem cells to create new blood products. That's not particularly exciting because it doesn't involve making those cells change the direction of specialization, which is kind of the holy grail of this field. With the embryonic stem cells, which are more elastic, more flexible, and also are easier to manipulate in the laboratory, we've actually seen some very dramatic results in animal models. For example, we have seen rats that have been paralyzed be given a therapy using rat embryonic stem cells and have actually been able to regain the ability to walk. But have we seen that in humans? No. There's a company in California named Geron. They are, by the way, the same company that funded the initial research here in Wisconsin. And that company has approached the Food and Drug Administration for permission to begin human trials for spinal cord injury using human embryonic stem cells. And the expectation is that sometime early in 2008, they will begin clinical trials.
My guest this morning is Alta Sharo, Warren P. Knowles Professor of Law and Bioethics at UW-Madison. She's also the co-chair of the Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research Advisory Committee at the National Academy of Sciences. And we're talking about stem cell research and the politics of that topic. The United States House of Representatives passed a bill which would relax some of the restrictions that President Bush wants or has placed on stem cell research. He's promised to veto that legislation, and so far it doesn't look like the House has enough votes to override that veto. What do you think? There are phone lines open for you to join our conversation, and we invite you to do that. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's toll-free anywhere you can hear this broadcast. 800-642-1234. If you're in Madison, you can call us at 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 8:22 on this Monday morning. John Munson sitting in for Joy Cardine this week. And coming up after 9:00 this morning, Kathleen Dunn will be along, and she and her guests will provide a recap of all the major political headlines from last week. That's after 9:00 with Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network. Stem cell research is the topic under discussion this hour, and if you'd like to join that discussion, here's how you can do it. Call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, toll-free anywhere you can hear this broadcast. If you're in Madison, give us a call at 263-1890, 263-1890. My guest this hour is Alta Sharo, who is the Warren P. Knowles Professor of Law and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also co-chair of the Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research Advisory Committee at the National Academy of Sciences, and she joins us by phone this morning. Well, law and bioethics, that sounds like a really interesting combination. How does... There have been ethical discussions surrounding embryonic stem cell research since it was first proposed. This has been a pretty hot debate. Where are we now in terms of what we know about embryonic stem cell research and the ethical considerations of that? Maybe compare it since when we first started looking into this.
Well, there's been interest in human embryonic stem cell research for maybe 25 years, but it was only about 10 years ago that we actually were in a position to ask the question of whether we should fund the research, and that's because Jamie Thompson's work here at Wisconsin, for the very first time, isolated human embryonic stem cells and manipulated them into lines or collections of cells that could be maintained in a way that makes them useful for research or for therapy. And from the outset, there was a very heated debate about whether this research not only should be publicly funded, but even should be legal, because its initial step, which is the isolation of the embryonic stem cells, requires extracting them from human embryos at the 3, 4, 5 day stage of development. And the debate quickly turned then to the same debate we have in many ways about abortion, which is whether the earliest stages of human life have a moral status that requires that we first allow that form of life to develop however it might, and second, even more dramatically, whether there's an obligation to even assist it to develop to term. Remember, the embryos that we're talking about here are embryos that are not going to develop into children because they are surplus embryos that are being discarded by couples at IVF clinics. And so, left alone, they would not develop into children, but some would argue we are morally obligated to do everything possible to make them develop into children, if there's any way we can do that. So from the very outset, this debate has been very similar to the abortion debate. Over time, the growing appreciation for the impossibility of bringing all these embryos to term as children, the lack of interested people to so-called adopt them, and the sheer number of them, hundreds of thousands of them, coupled with the promise for research and therapy for people who are already alive but are sick, has really caused a change in public opinion. And if you look at the polls over the last 10 years, you see a steady shift on the part of the public from widespread discomfort to now a pretty sustained majority support for funding this research and pursuing it aggressively. That said, there is still a very strong opposition to it among a minority of U.S. citizens.
Let's go to the phones and see what some of our callers have to say about this topic. We'll go first to Walt in Wausau. Walt, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. I'd just like to say, first of all, I hate to think I agree with Governor Doyle on anything, but anything that can be accomplished in science is going to be, one way or another. And if we ban all this type of research, all we're going to do is be shipping another potential moneymaker overseas for somebody else to use.
Thanks for the call. Well, what do you think? If we don't do it here in the U.S., somebody else is going to do it somewhere, and we'll just be left out?
Well, that's already happened. Most of the research in this field in the United States has been hampered both by the lack of full federal funding and also just by the chilling effect of the political climate here. And in places like the United Kingdom, we see instead a robust government program to support and regulate the research. In the United States, if the federal government were funding this research more aggressively, then all of the existing federal regulations on science and human experimentation would come into play. But unfortunately, without that funding, those regulations simply don't apply. So the United Kingdom has certainly been out in front on research in this area. Other places in the world that are very aggressively pursuing it include Singapore, India, China, Australia, so that the U.S. certainly is in a position to lose its so-called competitive edge. Within the United States, there's also a competition, because we're now seeing a very interesting and novel phenomenon. That is, individual states choosing to fund basic science research, something they typically do not do because the federal government handles it. And so California is way out ahead in the United States in terms of funding this research and creating very, very significant centers for this research in the San Diego, Los Angeles, and San Francisco areas. Wisconsin has fallen far behind in many ways to California's effort. And coming up behind California, we have New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Maryland, all in the business of funding this research.
This isn't necessarily a Democrat-Republican issue, is it?
It's not, although it has broken down according to those lines somewhat, but not completely. And that's because, to the extent that members of the Republican Party have been elected because of support from those who oppose abortion, you find that they are very cautious about supporting funding for anything that might be associated with some tolerance of the destruction of early forms of human life. That said, in the United States Congress, we've seen some very prominent Republicans come out in favor of expanded support in this area. In the Senate, for example, we had Senators Specter from Pennsylvania, Senator Orrin Hatch, a strong abortion rights opponent from Utah, also calling for more funding, and similarly conservative members of the House.
We have more callers waiting to join us. Let's go next to Jane in Minocqua. Jane, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to thank you for pursuing in this research effort and for having the program on the air to explain it, because I think there's so many misconceptions regarding it. And I agree with the previous caller that this is going to be done. It's just a matter of time, and hopefully it'll be done soon. I work in the healthcare field as an occupational therapist for 35 years, and I'm so excited about what this might do for paraplegics and all those areas. My question is, what can I do on a personal level to help get this bill passed?
Well, at this moment, there is no bill that needs to be passed at the federal level. The House and Senate have twice passed legislation to increase federal funding. The first time it was vetoed by President Bush, and he made an announcement while at the G8 summit recently that he planned to veto this again. So at the federal level, I think either we're going to see some shenanigans in Congress attempting to attach this funding bill to some other kind of legislation, or we're simply going to be waiting to see what the next president, who the next president is, and what his or her views might be on this. At the state level, it is valuable, I think, for people across Wisconsin to register their opinions with their state representatives in both the Assembly and the Senate. Governor Doyle has identified funding for biotechnology research in general, including stem cell funding, but we do have a state legislature that is less than completely supportive of this work and periodically embarks on debates on bills that would ratchet back either the legality or funding of some aspects of it. So as citizens, making sure that your local representatives understand where you think the state ought to go on this can really help to keep the legislature attuned to public opinion.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jane. We had a caller who wanted to know more specifics about the stem cells being used. He says there are different parts of the cell that can be used, an inner layer and an outer layer, which have different purposes. Would the legislation recently passed at the House level affect all use of all parts of the stem cell for any kind of research?
Well, I'm afraid I think that the caller may have gotten the biology just a little bit off. If you look at the earliest stages of embryonic development, the early embryo, or the blastocyst, as it's called, does have an inner and an outer layer. Not the individual stem cell, but the blastocyst, which is a collection of cells, has an outer layer that ordinarily would become the placenta, and an inner layer, the inner cell mass, which would ordinarily develop into the fetus and have all the cells of the body. So it's the inner cell mass of this early embryo that is used to derive embryonic stem cells. The outer layer is not used. But the stem cell itself is a single cell, not with an inner and outer layer.
Okay, let's go back to the phones, and next we'll take a caller from Milwaukee. Phil, you're on. Good morning.
I think we need to trace where the business model of this is going to go and see who benefits. This technology, even if it starts out with small startup companies and, you know, fresh-faced new biotech, is going to end up being gobbled up by multinational corporations. Multinational drug corporations and medical corporations who are fat with profit. And why should we be giving these people who should be taking their own fat profits to develop new technology, why should we be funding their development? And especially because none of us who are alive today will probably benefit that greatly from it. Only the very richest people will get the first benefits from it, because, of course, these technologies will be fantastically expensive at first. So I can't see why I should give my tax money to benefit a multinational corporation who are sitting on fat profits already to develop a new technology that will probably never benefit me.
The caller is touching upon what has become a very important part of the debate here, and that has to do with the social justice considerations of both funding this research and in deploying its technologies when it comes to fruition. So let me speak to two things. The first is a generic problem having to do with the way research is done in the United States. The pharmaceutical companies do, in fact, have tremendous assets, but they also do not tend to invest in the earliest stages of research because most research never actually develops into a usable consumer product. Most research goes down other paths that may be scientifically interesting but doesn't actually yield a marketable product. And so companies tend to wait until the research has moved forward through the initial stages and then come in at a later stage to begin investing. If they did otherwise, they would be investing in things that lose money, their share prices drop, and they run into problems as corporations. That's simply a reality about how the business world operates and is a larger problem than stem cell research, certainly. It's a more general problem about research and development in the United States. But if I may, very quickly, I'm sorry, I know you want to cut in, but I think the caller may not realize that there are some benefits that may actually help people much sooner and people who are much poorer. And that is, one of the earliest uses of embryonic stem cells is going to be to create laboratory models of diseases, to grow tissues in a dish or disease in a dish that you can use to test new drugs, which means you can test the drugs faster and more safely than you can with human clinical trials. You can see whether or not a drug is going to be toxic to heart tissue if you've got the heart muscle tissue growing in your laboratory dish. So to the extent that we need to have drugs develop more quickly with fewer individuals going through clinical trials, that is a more short-term application of this particular technique.
Phil, if you're still with us, a question for you. Where do you stand on stem cell research in general? Forget about who's going to make money off it eventually. Do you think we should be further doing the research, and what's your position on that?
If we could take this out of the hands of people who are pretty much, okay, I would have to differ with Ms. Charo's opinion that the drug companies don't believe and are afraid of this technology because they're cheerleading through proxies. That's what this whole program we're listening to this morning is about, the promise. We're constantly being told that stem cell research is going to solve everything but death and taxes, and will probably solve death. So I don't think that the companies are at all afraid of this. I think what we have here is the drug company equivalent of Bud Selig saying, unless you build me a new stadium, we're going to leave.
Topic is stem cell research this hour. We have some lines open now for you at 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, 800-642-1234. You can call us from Madison at 263-1890. Let's go next to Sasha in Stevens Point. Sasha, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. I was just calling to reiterate the call for people to vocalize their support for embryonic stem cell research. I've been a caregiver for someone who was injured 4 years ago and is now quadriplegic, suffered a spinal cord injury. And, you know, we've talked to a lot of people about this, and people simply don't understand that these are cells that are going to be thrown into the garbage anyway. And why not put these cells to use and preserve life and give people back the things that may have been taken from them, whether it be due to an injury or an accident. And I just really want people to also look beyond themselves and their family members and think about the benefits for other people and not always think about the profit or what your tax dollars are going to be used on that might not directly benefit you. So I just want people to think about others that are out there who have been affected by a disease or an injury or what have you, and think about the great benefits of embryonic stem cell research and just to really vocalize that support, because I think a lot of people just don't understand and turn it into a political joke, which I'm completely, you know, sick of all the political battles about it. So just wanted to voice my support, and thank you for having this program this morning.
And thanks for the call.
No, one thing I would note is, and it concerns the comments by both of the last two callers, is that one of the unfortunate effects of the political controversy surrounding this particular medical research is that it has driven the media to discuss it in rather exaggerated terms. That is, we talk about the benefits of stem cell research when, more accurately, we should say the possible benefits. We had a similar run about 20 years ago with the earliest stages of gene therapy, which also showed tremendous theoretical promise. And it's now been two decades with a number of notable failures, and now finally in the last couple of years, some very incremental small successes. Science simply doesn't work in these dramatic ways. It tends to be very incremental. And yet, because of the need to fight a battle over funding, we tend to have exaggerated claims of near-term therapies or exaggerated statements that we don't need this at all because something else will work instead. Neither statement is completely accurate. And the short-term application that I described before about using these cells to create disease models in the laboratory for faster and safer and cheaper drug development is not as sexy as helping people to walk again. And yet this drug development area is probably the most important initial application for this field. It's just not going to get a lot of excitement in the Congress.
Well, and the way the debate has been framed, depending on what side of it you're coming from, on the one hand, you've got people saying that this research is the equivalent of killing babies. On the other side, you've got people saying, well, if you don't, if you're not in favor of this research, that means that you want people to suffer and die who could benefit from it. It seems to me that that type of rhetoric isn't really very helpful if you're trying to get at the truth.
It isn't helpful in an ideal world, but it has been very helpful in the political world because it's been those kinds of exaggerated statements from all sides that has really galvanized the political debate and has caused bills to be introduced and either passed or voted down. So from a political standpoint, exaggeration is very useful. It makes it easier to debate this, makes for better sound bites. The reality is that science is too complicated for sound bites.
What do scientists say when they're talking to each other about this stuff?
Well, I'm not a working scientist. I, however, spend a lot of time at meetings with them. And I would say that overall, there is just a tremendously widespread consensus that this is fascinating and potentially revolutionary research that's going on not only here but all over the world now. But that also it needs time to develop. There are many unsexy things that have to be done in order to bring this to fruition, starting from the most unsexy, which is how do you simply culture these cells in a laboratory dish so that they're maintained in a usable state? And lots of research here at Wisconsin on the details of how you culture it and how you manipulate the lines. Scientists also recognize that this is an insight into certain fundamental aspects of human biology, which may or may not have a direct application in therapy. Simply understanding how it is that a cell can divide and divide and divide and become not only different kinds of tissue, but an organized set of tissues so that our liver is only where our liver is supposed to be, and our skin is only where our skin is supposed to be. This is a tremendously interesting area of human biology that is not yet completely understood. This area of research gives us insights into that. Will that someday help us to understand normal human development and abnormal development? Will it someday help us to predict or prevent birth defects or diseases? One can hope so, but it may not. It may simply be basic science.
We're talking about stem cell research with our guest, Alta Sharo, who is the Warren P. Knowles Professor of Law and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and also the co-chair of the Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research Advisory Committee at the National Academy of Sciences. What do you think? We've still got some lines open and a chance for you to call us at 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. If you're in Madison, use 263-1890. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just about 13 minutes before 9 o'clock, coming up after 10 o'clock this morning, Kathleen Dunn and her guest examine how race, gender, economic status, and education can work for and against you. That's after 10 o'clock this morning here on the Ideas Network. Stem cell research is what we're talking about now. Last week, the United States House of Representatives passed a bill very similar to one that had already been vetoed by President Bush, and he promises to veto this one as well. Congress and the president are sort of locking horns on the stem cell issue. At this point, it does not appear that either house of the legislature at the federal level has the votes to override the promised veto of this legislation. And our guest this morning is Alta Sharo, Warren P. Knowles Professor of Law and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and co-chair of the Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research Advisory Committee at the National Academy of Sciences. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, the toll-free number to call. And in Madison, it's 263-1890. Let's go back to the phones, and next we'll go to Tim in Michigan. Tim, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Put it blankly, the prior callers have pretty well overshadowed anything I really had to say. Except for if Bush is vetoing this on religious or obscene reasons or some darn thing, I wish he would stop the war in Iraq. That is the most obscene and really irreligious thing that could be done. The stem cells research is the going thing. My degree was in chemistry, and I haven't seen anything new, different, or interesting happen in chemistry or physics in years and years, maybe decades. We should be charging ahead. Wisconsin should get a good chunk of this. We could put the state on the map worldwide if we wanted to.
Well, what about that? If the federal government was able to be more actively involved in funding embryonic stem cell research, how would Wisconsin benefit?
Well, we would benefit in several different ways. First, we are a state that has a far smaller population and tax base than a state like California. And so there's no way that we could ever compete with California if we had to rely primarily on state funding. So having federal funding available certainly helps to even the playing field within the United States. But there's another less obvious benefit to having federal funding, and that is to have uniform national regulation of the field so that scientists all have the same rules for how they can obtain human materials, whether it's eggs or somatic cells or embryos, what they can and cannot do with them in their laboratories, how they begin to move toward human or animal trials and then human trials. Right now, each state that funds in this area has to create its own ethical oversight rules, both substantive, what you can and cannot do, and procedural, how you get permission and how you document what you've done. And if a scientist in California wants to collaborate with a scientist in New York and a scientist in Wisconsin, The chances are today that each of these scientists is going to be subject to different rules and different procedures. And the process of trying to harmonize these so that you can work together or even just exchange materials across state lines, very difficult, very time-consuming, and it might actually slow down the research considerably. So having a national approach to this helps to unleash all of the promise of collaborative science as opposed to the kind of parochial science that we're now seeing develop on a state-by-state basis.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Bernadette in Luck. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because I believe the truth is paramount, and I believe in stem cell research to the hilt, but I do not believe in embryonic stem cell research because that is life, and we should cherish life at every state of its being. And as far as the babies in the petri dishes, I think maybe we should have some preliminary setup in cases like this, either with the potential parents and the medical personnel, adoption agencies. And they should work together to find homes for these lives because, like I say, truth is paramount. Embryonic stem cells are life, and we should treat it as life. Thank you so much.
Well, I think the caller certainly touched on what is at the core of this debate, which is what is the moral significance of an embryo? These are not babies in petri dishes. They are embryos in petri dishes from which we then derive embryonic stem cells for our petri dishes. And the question is whether or not an embryo should be treated with the same legal and moral significance as a live-born baby. This is a debate that predates embryonic stem cell research. I would note for the caller that trying to bring every embryo to fruition as a term birth is probably not realistic. We've got upwards of 400,000 or 500,000 of these around the world frozen and not being used. And there is no possibility of finding 400,000 to 500,000 women who want to take these into their bodies and try to bring them to term. So if the objection is to the loss of embryos that are frozen at fertility clinics, the real debate then should be about whether or not this particular form of fertility treatment, that is in vitro fertilization, which results in so many embryos, should itself be permitted. And that's a debate that did occur in the 1980s when in vitro fertilization was new. Over time, it seems to have become part of the fabric of American life. And although there was at least one member of our state legislature, I believe it was Stephen Fries, who suggested a few years ago in a bill that we take a closer look at fertility clinics in Wisconsin, by and large, we have not seen any movement by either Democrats or Republicans to ban in vitro fertilization. And that's really the only way that one could eliminate this issue of hundreds of thousands of embryos that simply are never going to be brought to term.
What's going to happen to these embryos? A previous caller said they're going to be destroyed. Is that in fact what happens to them at some point?
By and large, they are either destroyed at the direction of those who made them. And let me back up very quickly, because I know we're running out of time, to say that when couples go through these procedures, there are medical reasons why the process tends to create more embryos than you can use. So after they've used as many as they can to make their families, there are often some left over. Those embryos tend to either stay frozen in perpetuity, and after a certain number of years are probably not safe to use to try to make a child because of the long freezing process, or they're discarded at the direction of the people who made them. In either case, they simply cannot or will not become children under any circumstances.
Let's go back to the phones and take another call. This time we'll go to Harmony in Eau Claire. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for having this program. I think there's a lot of general confusion on this subject. My question is whether or not cells from placentas and afterbirth can be used in the same way that the embryonic stem cells are being used, because I've heard that argument that we should just use cells from placentas.
Yeah, there's been some very interesting research that is still at its initial stages. that suggests that the cells that are obtained from the umbilical cord blood, or cells that are obtained from amniotic fluid, or now from the research last week, cells from skin that have been manipulated genetically, all can be coaxed into a state where they would throw off cells that act just like embryonic stem cells. None of these are yet completely proven techniques. The amniotic fluid and umbilical cord blood sources are still under, they're still undergoing additional research to try to replicate some of these findings. The work announced last week, we now have seen three labs replicate some of the work that involves taking a skin cell from a mouse and genetically manipulating it so that it acts like an embryonic stem cell, or it acts like a cell that can generate embryonic stem cells. But that's in the mouse. And the very genes they had to manipulate in the mouse cell are different from the ones they will ultimately have to manipulate in the human system. So we don't know if it'll be a year or 10 years before that research comes to fruition and provides a genuine alternative to the use of cell lines that come ultimately from human embryos.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to make sure we can kind of wrap things up and let people know what the state of this is now. The Congress has passed another law or another bill, and the president says he'll veto it. There's not enough votes to override. What did we accomplish?
Every one of these votes, I think, sends a signal to the other members of Congress who voted against it that there is indeed public support and there is legislative support. If and when the White House attitudes change, it helps to set us up for funding at the federal level. If the White House attitude does not change, I think that these kinds of votes on the national level send a signal back down to the state level and allow state legislators to think more closely about whether or not they can feel safe in voting in favor of this funding. So, to some extent, what we're seeing now is really a public relations game.
This was not a big issue in the last presidential campaign, but it sounds like it's shaping up to be one in the coming campaign.
Actually, I would say that it was a huge issue in the last presidential campaign. It was mentioned in two of the three televised debates, and we also saw it playing out in local events all over the country. It also was probably responsible for flipping the Senate, which only flipped by one seat, because in Missouri, a related debate about the use of cloning to create embryos from which you could get embryonic stem cells was on the ballot as a constitutional issue and also was an issue that divided the two senatorial candidates. And the candidate who favored a more expansive and aggressive approach toward embryonic stem cell research was the one who won, and that resulted in the Senate changing parties.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us today. Alta Shara, Warren P. Knowles, Professor of Law and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.